Morning, Your Honor. Ryan Bounds for the United States, the appellant in this matter. May it please the Court. In dismissing the indictment in this criminal prosecution, the district court below held that the defendant's apparent eligibility for a voluntary departure as relief from removal during his removal hearing in 2004 could be assessed with respect to this Court's subsequent precedent and could be deemed to be available even though this Court's precedents at the time and the precedents of the Board of Immigration Appeals at the time plainly foreclosed such relief from removal. In fact, that is undisputed and was not even considered by the district court. In dismissing the indictment, the district court erred in holding that apparent eligibility, which is the standard under the regulation, can be determined without respect to this Court's and the Board's then-prevailing case law. This Court, in fact, has never held that an alien in removal proceedings is entitled to advice about his apparent eligibility for relief from removal that is inconsistent with this Court's then-prevailing holdings.
Let me ask you about Lopez-Velasquez, because you rely heavily on Lopez-Velasquez in your briefing. And Lopez-Velasquez says, well, the general rule is we don't fault the IJ for not anticipating new case law, but under certain narrow circumstances, citing Leon Paz, we do. We will look at subsequently decided case law in making the 1326D analysis. What's the delineation between, how do we distinguish between those cases where we don't fault the IJ, we don't say that there was a due process issue for purposes of a collateral attack, and those where we do? I mean, Leon Paz was a St. Cyr type situation. So help me understand how we would draw that line in light of Lopez-Velasquez.
At the very least, the line in Lopez-Velasquez clearly falls along whether there was holdings, whether there were holdings by this Court and the Board of Immigration Appeals that interpreted the statutory provision at issue. There, of course, it was domicile for purposes of 212C relief. In this case, it's voluntary departure and the definition of aggravated felony. But it's plain in the Lopez-Velasquez context that there was no holding from this Court about the potential retroactive effect of St. Cyr. It was an open question when the removal proceedings at issue in that case occurred.
Leon Paz, I think there was a BIA decision saying we read AEDPA and ARERA to apply in this way, and the IJ followed that, correct?
I don't know that there was a Board of Immigration Appeals decision squarely on point. That was a fairly early removal proceeding. I believe it was 1998, so within about a year of the effective date of ARERA. In any event, it's not the government's position that this Court can't consider a question de novo and determine that both the Board of Immigration Appeals and the IJ got it wrong as a matter of first impression. Our position is a narrower one, which is where this Court has held to the contrary, that the BIA and the IJ were correct when the advice was given.
Well, even St. Cyr, though, was not absolute in the sense that the alien still had to show detrimental reliance, so that St. Cyr did not apply retroactively to an alien who decided to go to trial rather than plead guilty.
Fair enough. But again, the issue for purposes of examining this case was whether there was any precedent holding that it might be the case, or it's presumptively the case that the 212C amendments were not retroactive, and there was no such holding. And so the IJ's advice couldn't be assessed against the background of this Court's holdings. That is plainly not the case here. It is undisputed that against this Court's holdings, the IJ's advice to the defendant in 2004 was correct. He was not eligible for voluntary departure because he had committed sexual abuse of a minor, had been convicted of sexual abuse of a minor when he was convicted of third-degree rape in Oregon.
Now, there's no Ninth Circuit case specifically that at the time the IJ made the decision that was specifically construing the particular statute at issue. Is that right?
That's right.
So we have like Marin Medina, and the statutes that they were construing referred to minors who were 14 years
Baron Medina referred to a California statute, Penal Code 288A, that specifically referred to victims under the age of 14. Then the year before the removal proceeding in this case, there was the Virginia Carnal Knowledge Statute that referred to victims under the age of 15. And importantly, this court in Baron Medina affirmed the fact that the California statute categorically constituted sexual abuse of a minor, totally without respect to any age difference requirement. There is none in that case. And the 14-year-old cutoff in that statute wasn't central either because, of course, in 2003, this court in Pereira-San Marón relied on Baron Medina to find that the case, the statute at the issue in that case, which involved victims older than 14, was also a sexual abuse of a minor conviction.
So let's assume for the moment that we deem Baron Medina in that line of cases to be squarely on point in saying that the statute at issue, under our case law, the statute at issue here, the crime of conviction, would have been sexual abuse of a minor. Is the government seeking a rule that where there's Ninth Circuit opinion more or less squarely on point, then the IJ can't be faulted for not anticipating en banc opinion or subsequent Supreme Court opinion that might change that law? Is that what the rule you're looking for?
Exactly. And we contend that that is the rule of Lopez-Velasquez. Again, in Lopez-Velasquez, the argument about the proper interpretation of domicile for purposes of the defendant's potential eligibility or apparent eligibility for cancellation of removal was not necessarily foreclosed by Castillo-Felix, the 1979 decision, as is plainly evident from the fact that the case on which he relied that was a year after his removal was simply a three-judge panel decision that held a new statute, a new day for the interpretation of domicile. So it can't be argued that it has to be squarely on point. It has to be an Asbury-like decision that says Oregon Rape 3 is categorically sexual abuse of a minor. And I should emphasize also that not only was this Court's case law squarely supporting the IJ's advice to the alien in 2004, but the IJ was also relying on an even broader interpretation of the definition of sexual abuse of a minor by the BIA in 1999 in matter of Rodriguez-Rodriguez. And that definition, which was very broadly encompassing, was, albeit subsequently, but affirmed by this Court as entitled to deference and a proper interpretation of sexual abuse of a minor. So here we have a BIA precedent decision en banc holding that the definition of sexual abuse of a minor is very broad, categorically includes conduct much less serious and involving victims much older than victims of the Oregon Rape 3 statute, an interpretation that this Court then subsequently affirms as proper, as well as this Court's own interpretations that hold that the use of young children, including children over the age of 14, categorically for sexual gratification, categorically constitutes sexual abuse of a minor. And the Baron Medina case involved conduct that was that did not even involve necessarily interpersonal conduct with a victim, whereas, of course, this case involved actual rape, that is, sexual penetration of a victim under the age of 16.
Let me make sure I understand what you're arguing. Are you arguing the point now that what? That the law was clearly established?
Yes.
In the way you're explaining it?
Quite plainly, yes. And that's never been disputed.
Even though it turned out to be wrong?
It did turn out to be wrong when this Court reversed a long series of its own decisions almost 5 years later, yes.
So when the case law is, I'll just say, solid enough, the IJ is entitled to rely on that. And, these new cases don't apply in terms of retroactively taking a second look. Is that your argument?
Well, there are two points I'd want to make on that. First of all, this case does not at all involve actual eligibility. The question is not whether, in a platonic sense, in a world in which the proper interpretation, according to Estrada Espinoza, was known to all parties or could be divined by all parties, applied. The only question is whether he was apparently eligible, whether it was properly foreseeable by the IJ that Estrada Espinoza would be handed down and would conceivably affect this defendant's actual eligibility if he appealed to this Court. We now know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it would not have helped this defendant at all. And so it's not so much whether he was actually eligible in light of the case law at the time. The question is whether he was apparently eligible, and he plainly was not. And Estrada Espinoza has no effect on his apparent eligibility. So when this – when the defendant argues citing a bunch of appeals for, or petitions for review of removal orders directly from the Board of Immigration Appeals, those cases are inapposite. Here we're just talking about the validity of his waiver of appeal and administrative relief and his capacity to launch the collateral attack at issue here. He had no capacity because he validly waived appeal, because he was properly advised based on this Court's case law at the time. I also do want to emphasize that it is not our position that the defendant wasn't, even as an actual matter, eligible for or was, as an actual matter, eligible for voluntary departure. Our argument is to the contrary, that he wasn't, because he admitted that he was 5 years older at least. He was, in fact, 6 years older than the victim in that case, in his plea petition.
Modified categorical argument?
Pardon?
This is your modified categorical argument.
Exactly, which is, I should emphasize, an alternative basis for reversing the district court. But we think either under Lopez-Velasquez or under
– whether or not he's 5 years old or not is neither here nor there, because that's not a required element of the statute, is it?
It's not a required element, but Aguila Montes de Oca held that for purposes of the modified categorical determination, it needn't be required as an element of the offense. It need only be necessarily found within the documents that are available under Shepard.
Well, but it had to be a necessary part of the defenses of the government's theory, and there was because there is no age limit of any sort. It wasn't a necessary part of anything, right? He just wrote down what his age was.
It was necessary insofar as the affirmative defense of an age difference made it centrally relevant to the conviction in that case. And trial courts in Oregon are required to assess the defendant's age and capacity to make a plea, as well as the availability of affirmative defenses. And as this Court held in United States v. Asbury, that the availability of that affirmative defense made the Oregon Rape 3 statute materially indistinguishable from the federal statute, which also required an age difference of 4 years.
Is there a statutory basis for the affirmative defense of an age difference in
yes.
under Oregon law? What do you, can you cite what the statute is?
Yes, it's Oregon Revised Statute 163.345 on the same page in the Oregon Code Book as the Rape 3 statute, which is subsection 355.
And that's the provision that says that there must be at least a three-year difference between.
But it's an affirmative defense in quasi-consensual cases.
If it's less than 3 years.
Yes.
3 years or less.
Yes. And as this Court has already held, you know, if there's an age difference at issue in the case for purposes of criminal culpability, that is plainly within the parameters of the modified categorical approach.
So your position is that when the Washington County Circuit Court judge took the plea, he necessarily had to determine that the defendant was not eligible for the affirmative defense in order to determine that he was, in fact, guilty of a rape in the third degree?
In order to take a valid plea, he had to make a finding that the defendant's age did not give rise to a plainly available affirmative defense.
Why would he have to do that? Does he have to make an affirmative finding that the defendant was not insane? I mean, there are a whole bunch of affirmative defenses.
In order to take a constitutionally valid plea, yes. If the defendant was insane and the district court failed to take account of that, he could collaterally attack his conviction based on the fact that it was an invalid, involuntary plea.
I've never heard that before. That, in other words, for a plea to be valid, it has to dispel all affirmative defenses that could possibly be applied. Can you cite a case to that effect?
Well, the Oregon Supreme Court had published a case that held that trial courts in taking pleas must consider the defendant's age and the availability of affirmative defenses in order to anticipate and dispel the possibility of collateral attacks on criminal convictions. So it's not, of course.
Brief? Is that case cited in your brief?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Bounds, you've run over about 4 minutes.
Sorry. If I could reserve 1 minute just for rebuttal, Your Honor.
I'll give you a minute on rebuttal. Let's hear from counsel for Mr. Vidal-Mendoza.
Thank you very much.
And I'll give you a little extra time.
Good morning. It's our position that deportation hearing violated the defendant's due process rights because the IJ misadvised the defendant that he was ineligible for relief from deportation because of the purported aggravated felony conviction.
Well, he didn't misadvise him at the time, did he?
It's our position that what constitutes advice for the purposes of this appellate proceeding, for the purposes of the district court's determination, is what the law was.
Was or could be?
Well, what the law was, because judicial interpretations of law under clear precedent.
Well, when we say was at a given time.
The law with respect to what constituted sexual abuse of a minor for the purposes of the Immigration and Nationality Act was determined by this court in Estrada v. Espinoza.
But that was after the deportation hearing.
Correct. At the time, so if we go back in 2004.
So are you arguing for clairvoyance? Is that is that the position you're taking? He has to be able to divine a change in the law by the Ninth Circuit years later?
That's a focusing on what the IJ did at fault. And I think that that's not the appropriate way to look at that.
Well, let's come at this a different way. Yeah. Do you agree with Mr. Bounds that in 2004 this crime constituted sexual abuse of a minor under then applicable precedent of both the Board of Immigration Appeals and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals?
In 2004, I think the law was less settled than Mr. Rounds would suggest.
Counsel, it's a simple question.
Yeah,
either you agree with him or not. If the answer is no, then you can tell me why you disagree with him. Can you answer my question, yes or no?
And I do disagree.
All right. Now, tell me why you disagree.
And I disagree because I think the law was more complicated at that time. If we go back in 2004, there are a number of cases, Baron Medina, I think the only other case that was decided by the Ninth Circuit prior to the 2004 deportation hearing was Pereira-Salmeron. Both of those cases were interpreting what constituted, under what circumstances, sexual abuse of a minor constituted an aggravated felony for the purposes of the federal sentencing guidelines. In Barona Medina, the determination was that there was a 16-level enhancement under 2L1.2 for what at that time was an aggravated felony enhancement. And Pereira-Salmeron, which was decided in 2003, was an issue of crime of violence. In Rodriguez, we have the BIA making a wide-sweeping decision about various factors that immigration judges could consider in determining what constituted.
Let me see if we can get down to what's at issue. So, in view of your interpretation of the existing case law at the time, what should the IJ have said?
The IJ should have advised the, Mr. Vidal
Mendoza. Was unsettled?
That.
He says, I don't know what to tell you because there are these cases all over the place. Is that what he should have said?
Well, I think in these decisions, it's an open question what the IJ could or should have said. And I think the focus is on all the decisions that this Court and other courts.
Well, if it's an open question, then.
It's an open question in terms of what the IJ could have said. Our position is that the IJ should have advised Mr. Vidal Mendoza at that time that he was eligible for voluntary departure, that his conviction was not an aggravated felony, because it was not then and it is not now an aggravated felony.
So that's not based on the existing case law, because the existing case law, even if there was not a construal of that statute, opposing counsel argues, well, and the language is very broad, that under those cases, a conviction for that sort of crime, reasonably applying the case law, would be a sexual abuse of a minor. So although it's possible that the law could change, there was certainly nothing that would have told the IJ it was not a sexual abuse of a minor, was there?
Well, the law did – the law, in my opinion, did not change. When Estrada Espinoza – the law did change. The law changed when Estrada Espinoza made its decision because Estrada Espinoza overruled Afredi. But Afredi was decided in 2006. Estrada Espinoza did not overrule Barron Medina and the other decisions that were looking at and defining sexual abuse under the federal sentence guidelines. Indeed, this court recently, or in 2009, in Medina Villa, specifically states, quoting, rather than overruling Barron Medina, we affirmatively relied upon it in Estrada Espinoza. So there were cases out there in 2004 in other contexts that had interpreted sexual abuse of a minor under the guidelines. The Ninth Circuit had not interpreted sexual abuse of a minor for the purposes of the Immigration and Nationality Act.
If that's the case, then why couldn't the immigration judge rely on the en banc BIA decision in Rodriguez-Rodriguez, if you're telling us this was an open question under Ninth Circuit law? Because there's no Ninth Circuit precedent that would tell him he's wrong.
There was no Ninth Circuit precedent telling him that he was right on this issue.
Counsel, he's got a BIA decision that says you interpret it broadly, and he has no Ninth Circuit decision that says that interpretation is wrong. So what is he supposed to do? I have the same question.
In fact, isn't he bound by a precedential BIA decision?
Well, Rodriguez-Rodriguez has been interpreted by Estrada Espinoza as not a decision on point, rather a case that provided guidelines for analysis. It was therefore a case that was not, in this Court's opinion, entitled to deference under a Chevron analysis. It was simply a roadmap for courts to consider.
But let me ask you this, just to get to the more general rule. If there had been a Ninth Circuit case on point that told the IJ this sort of prior crime of conviction is sexual abuse of a minor, and the IJ had said, sorry, you're not eligible for voluntary departure because you were convicted of an aggravated felony, would that statement have been immune from collateral attack under 1326D subsequently? Do you agree with that general principle?
I don't, because I think even if there had been a Ninth Circuit decision on point, when the Ninth Circuit subsequently decided this issue, that Ninth Circuit decision is the statement of what the law is and always was. It applied at the time, retrospectively, to that prior proceeding. And while the IJ may not have been aware of that, would not have had the foresight of that, and therefore, to use the issue of fault, that there was some error that can be attributed to the IJ, I think is not the
well,
proper.
The error is his inability to divine what the Ninth Circuit would later declare. And we have case law that says IJs don't have to be clairvoyant.
And IJs can't be clairvoyant. Nobody can be clairvoyant.
But you're arguing that he must be, otherwise it's error.
No, what I'm arguing is that when a defendant is subsequently processed and prosecuted in a federal prosecution for illegal reentry, and one of the elements, one of the predicate elements of that prosecution is a prior deportation hearing, then this court and the district court has the hindsight and the foresight that the immigration judge lacked to assess due process issues, that deportation cannot support a criminal prosecution.
So Lopez Velasquez, we said we normally don't do that, that the correct procedure would have been a motion to reopen before he illegally reentered into the country, and said it's limited. That sort of retrospective look is limited to narrow circumstances. What are those narrow circumstances? Because what you're describing would be all circumstances where there's a change in the law that subsequently benefit a person being prosecuted under 1326.
Well, it would not include a change in statute, because the principle is that changes in statutes apply prospectively. Judicial decisions apply both retrospectively and prospectively.
The St. Cyr cases were saying that the IJ erred in not understanding that the new statutes didn't apply retroactively. So I'm not sure your stat line actually works either.
I believe that the error was in that the judicial interpretation of that statute, which is saying what the statute always was the St. Cyr Supreme Court decision. But
St. Cyr involved this element of detrimental reliance, which essentially constituted the prejudice prong of the due process analysis. And the problem here for your argument is your client in 2004, when he was convicted in Oregon, wouldn't be able to show detrimental reliance because the state of the law at that time didn't provide for any hope of relief, because it did, under the BIA's interpretation, constitute sexual abuse of a minor. So his decision to plead guilty, unlike the defendant in St. Cyr, who pled guilty because he relied on the fact that there were no adverse immigration consequences from the fact that he pled, is not the same situation that your client faced in 2004 in Washington County.
Well, to answer both of those questions in turn, with respect to the more recent one, what would have happened had the IJ informed Vidal Mendoza properly is that he could have applied for voluntary departure and would have substantially affected.
Well, in 2004, that would have been denied, though, would it not?
So we said in Melendez-Castro, I think is our recent decision, we said where the IJ says you're eligible for this relief, but I won't grant it because you have an aggravated felony conviction. We said that's the same as saying you're not entitled to an aggravated, you're not entitled to the relief. Mm-hmm. So isn't that what the IJ would have done in this case? You're theoretically entitled to voluntary departure, but in my view, you were convicted of an aggravated felony, so you're not eligible. And so it doesn't really make a distinction in this case.
In fact, the IJ did inform Mr. Vidal Mendoza that he was not entitled to any relief because he had an aggravated felony. At the same time that this was taking place, we have another case by this court that had a different turn of events. In Paleo Garcia, which was a 2004 proceeding, the IJ concluded that the defendant had an aggravated felony, denied Mr. Paleo's request for voluntary departure that involved a California statutory rape conviction that subsequently, in light of Estrada Espinoza, was determined not to be an aggravated felony. That individual, Paleo Garcia, appealed the decision, and the Ninth Circuit held that the IJ was incorrect, that it was not an aggravated felony, that the IJ was in error, and in fact, Mr. Paleo Garcia was entitled to relief, and therefore the
That was a direct appeal, though, right? That wasn't a
That was a direct appeal. But this Court has held, even though Estrada Espinoza had not been decided, even though the IJ did not have that clairvoyance or foresight of what this Court was going to hold, that was a flawed deportation proceeding, and the IJ was in error.
Okay. I've let you run over 4 minutes, too, so your time has expired. Thank you, Ms. Russell. Mr. Bounds, I'll give you a minute on rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It is of critical importance that this Court recognize that what is at issue here is not whether the defendant was actually eligible, whether the IJ thus correctly interpreted the statute in light of all available precedents from this Court, subsequent as well as precedent. What is at issue is only whether he was apparently eligible for voluntary departure, whether it was apparent that he had not committed an aggravated felony, and therefore he was entitled to advice that he was eligible for voluntary departure, and it was not apparent. What is apparent is if that he had been so advised.
I don't think the case has used the term apparent. I think it's, you know, whether he had a plausible ground for relief.
Well, it's apparent eligibility under the regulation has been interpreted this, by this Court to mean whether he was – whether relief was reasonably possible. Plausibility is the prejudice inquiry as to whether it would have been granted. But they're similar, to be sure. But it's not only implausible, it's patently impossible that the IJ's reliance on the yet-to-be-decided Estrada Espinoza would have resulted in relief for this defendant.
Oh, no. Well, it depends on, you know, what the procedure is in determining whether there's a reasonable ground or whether it's plausible or possible. The first question is he legally barred from seeking relief, right? And I think it's at that point that the IJ erred in this case, if you take prospective law into account, right? Because he is legally eligible for relief,
right,
isn't he?
But the question is not whether he is eligible. The question is whether he was apparently eligible.
Well, that's step one, all right? Whether he's legally eligible for some kind of relief.
The only question at issue is apparent eligibility, not actual eligibility.
And then the second, question is, you know, how much of a, I'll say, how much of a merit showing he has to make. And that's what you're arguing, right?
No. I'm arguing the threshold issue, whether he was apparently eligible for relief. And that, because that's what the standard that this Court has held. This Court has basically held that the apparent eligibility requirement under the regulation informs whether the defendant.
Well, he is eligible under, I'll say, our new law, right? Because he's not an aggravated felon.
That is totally undisputed. For purposes of this inquiry, although our position is that he wasn't eligible in light of the Aguila Montes issue, he had admitted he was 6 years older than the victim. So he wasn't actually eligible either. But for purposes of the Lopez Velasquez question, we concede that under Estrada Espinoza, he may not have been eligible.
Okay, so what's the next step?
That threshold inquiry. He wasn't apparently eligible. It cannot be plausibly argued that he didn't intelligently decide to waive appeal, and therefore that the waiver was invalid, and therefore excused, and thus allowing him to make this collateral attack. Had he sought voluntary departure, and had the IJ granted it, the Board of Appeals inevitably would have reversed, and this Court would have inevitably approved the Board of Appeals.
Reversed on what? For what reason?
Because it would have been contrary to the board's interpretation in Rodriguez-Rodriguez.
So we're asking whether he's excused from exhausting administrative remedies.
Yes.
And what we've said is, if the IJ misinforms the alien as to eligibility for relief, that's the same, that excuses his exhaustion because he can't appeal when he's been given this misinformation.
Yes.
And so the standard we're looking at is when is he excused? When is the alien excused from exhausting administrative remedies? When did because the IJ misinformed him? What is that standard for misinforming the alien?
Exactly.
Correct?
Whether the standard for misinformation is the law of this Court at the time or the law as this Court years later may determine it to be. And We're not arguing about the substantive retroactive application of Estrada Espinoza. We are arguing about whether the substantive application of that from a decision years after the fact has any bearing on the considered and intelligent waiver of appeal, and it cannot because it would have been.
What you're saying is even though we applied the law retroactively, even under that legal regime, there's no plausible basis for relief? Is that your argument?
There wasn't plausible. Apparent.
There was not.
Apparent eligibility as opposed to actual eligibility has to mean apparent at the time. And that's what the Court held in Lopez Velasquez.
Even under retroactive law, he was not apparently, he didn't show apparent eligibility. Is that your argument?
No, our argument is that the law is not retroactively applied for purposes of determining apparent eligibility as opposed to actual eligibility. This alien was not apparently eligible.
All right. I'm glad you clarified because I missed it.
Okay.
In fact, you'll have to write that down.
Thank you very much.
While you're writing that down, I'm going to have you sit down.
All right. Thank you very much. We do ask for the reversal of this report.
Thank you both. The argument actually was very helpful. We appreciate it very much.